from Breakthrough Nutrition. You're listening to NBS Nutrition, a show giving you a no bullshit take on sports nutrition and how it may or may not affect your performance.
What's up, everyone? I'm Cliff with Breakthrough Nutrition, here with our friend and co-host, Anthony Almada. Anthony is the CEO and president of Vitargo Global Sciences. Anthony, how are you today?
Good afternoon, Cliff.
All right. So last week, we started talking about ketogenic diets and how they relate to the performance world, mainly in endurance sports. We wanted to do a brief overview, but like most things with you and I, they carried a little long. So we're going to start round two, episode two today. But mainly what we're going to talk about is if you are an athlete who has decided to pursue a ketogenic lifestyle and you want to indulge yourself in endurance sports, how should you structure your week? What should your race day nutrition look like while following that ketogenic diet? Because we do know from studies that consuming the three B's, as you've stated, it just, you know, the beef, the butter, and what's the other? We'll say bullshit, but I know that's not right. But you know, consuming that diet of high fat, low carbohydrate just doesn't work on race day itself. So we need some carbohydrate. What are our options out there? What can we take? What works and what doesn't? All right. So before we get started, I wanna ask you just a random question. So maybe we'll start doing this every episode, something completely off topic, but it's something I thought about today. So I'm gonna ask you something completely random and you give us your answer. Doesn't need any explanation or anything like that. All right, you ready?
Okay, fire.
All right, so In terms of meals per day, 3 meals or 6 meals?
Whatever you can get in to get your total calories and protein in. The complement to that answer is the evidence so far in athletes does not show a significant advantage of one over the other based upon body composition changes, as long as the total calories and the macros are the same. The body will adapt. There are even some studies that go back decades where they gave people their protein in one dose a day and they did not lose muscle mass. So there's a lot of perception there in mythology, but right now the evidence doesn't align with the mythology.
Interesting. So, so we'll stop that there because I think we could talk about that stuff all day, but let's get onto the topic at hand. So I'm a ketogenic athlete. I consume a high fat, low carbohydrate, less than 50 grams per day. My protein is fairly moderate, somewhere the 0.8 gram range per kilogram of body weight.
Per pound.
Per pound, sorry, yes, you're correct, per pound. Maybe up to 1 gram per pound. And I'm going to race an endurance event on Saturday. Let's talk about what are my options to use and how I should use those. So in the talks of how our body is affected by insulin, there was a product that came out a couple of years ago, UCAN. Can you tell us a little bit about UCAN and then what the possible benefits of using that product may be for a ketogenic athlete?
Well, UCAN actually was invented by some researchers in the United Kingdom, in the UK, and it was intended, its original use was intended for people or children that have a problem regulating their blood sugar through their liver. It's a glycogen storage disease, and it was designed to provide another way to presumably trickle sugar into blood from eating a carb, because they have a problem regulating their blood sugar over the night and through the morning, early morning. And the intention of that product was then taken into the world of sport. And one of the people that is a noted researcher, Jeff Volek, PhD, is part of the advisory board for UCAN, Generation UCAN. And Jeff put together a study with a colleague of mine, Chad Kirksick, when he was at Oklahoma. And it's simply, a wax maize starch that's been heated up in water and processed. And there are a number of cornstarch products out there that are designed for the exact same result, to provide a slow release of sugar. But there's been one out there for quite a while for diabetics that they consume it at night and it trickles sugar into the blood. And they've never compared Yucan to off-the-shelf waxy maize starch, which a number of companies have. So one doesn't know if it is better or worse or equal, but it's much more expensive. In that first study that Chad Kirkstick did, a couple of my colleagues were involved in that study, they showed in competitive cyclists that compared to maltodextrin, that the blood insulin response that followed 30 minutes after they got Yucan compared to maltodextrin was much lower. But once they began cycling, as is found with any carbohydrate, once you begin doing continuous exercise, blood insulin drops dramatically. And within 30 minutes after the dose, the blood insulin was the same in the maltodextrin group. They also showed that both carbs, Yucan and maltodextrin, showed a significant blood sugar drop within about an hour and a half or about an hour after the ride, in a 150-minute ride. They showed no change in performance. They showed no change in perceived exertion. They showed no increase in fat burning. They showed no decrease in carb burning. So the question that came from that study that we've heard is, well, what does it do then? If it just keeps insulin low before you ride, what is the advantage? That study did not reveal an advantage. A second study came out in 2016 where they compared it to Gatorade. And uniquely, they showed that Generation Yucan was significantly higher in creating bloating in the athletes, although they did show a mild increase in fat burning, but no advantage in performance. And the way that they measured fat burning is indirect via the breath. They didn't do muscle biopsies, so one doesn't know what it actually did to the use of fuels in the human body directly. So right now, it's proposed as a fuel that has a low insulin response, but there are no studies that support it in terms of it being superior for fueling in relation to performance. And it has one study giving it a knock that actually may reduce gastric comfort or induce gastric distress in athletes.
And it's interesting that you compare, you know, you've compared it to just your normal off the shelf waxy maize. I've used waxy maize before while endurance training, and I just couldn't stomach the taste of it. Actually, was running, trying to drink it, and ended up throwing it back up into my mouth. But it was fairly expensive. I'm like, I don't want to spit it out, so I'm just going to re-swallow it because I don't want to waste the money. I'll tell anyone, it doesn't matter how good it is for you if you can't get it out of your bottle. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't do anyone any good. So it's interesting though that it's very similar to straight waxy maize, but we don't know if one actually performs better than the other. So,
well, it is a wax based starch, but it's been thermally processed, or as they say in the first paper, hydrothermally, so hot water processed. It may be better,
yeah,
but it just doesn't support that. And if you look at the label recommendations, they don't advocate high doses, and that's why I think for a lot of people that use it, they swear by it because they don't get bloated, but they don't use amounts that would match the fuel or the carb utilization rate of a competing athlete. You're talking maybe up to 150, 180 grams of carbs being burned an hour, maybe 200 if you're doing some intensive climbing work or racing and overtaking. Yet the recommendations are 35, 40 grams or 50 grams, I think, maximum per hour.
Right.
So you take that out, that may not be sufficient, but it will be tolerable. But that head-to-head against Gatorade, it caused bloating.
Gotcha. So, I mean, for a long time, I mean, the standard has basically been, you know, was glucose, maybe mixed with some other sugar. You know, all the studies that we look at from PowerBar and Gatorade, it's dual channels of burning carbohydrate. You know, so if we add fructose to maltodextrin, we're going to be able to utilize more grams of carbohydrate per hour. You and I have talked about this. I mean, those studies were done at, you know, 60% VO2 max. No one races at that intensity. So is that really beneficial? But so let's talk about an athlete that's been ketogenic and then is going to consume just your standard mixture of maltodextrin plus fructose on race day?
Well, for some, that would be very effective. And as we've talked about before, as with keto diets, there are very likely, and a small amount of evidence would support this, that some will do very well with a maltodextrin fructose blend. Some will do very poorly. Some will do well with maltodextrin alone. And it's a matter of one, trying it, and two, trying it long enough because there appears to be gut adaptation to a certain fuel source. So it's a trial and error. But the one thing that often is the limit is the perceived limit as to how much one can take per hour at race pace. That's a very, very fun and even polarizing topic, because the watchword among coaches is no more than 300 calories per hour. And that's 75 right. grams of carbs. And some people will even advocate 200. That will likely be insufficient if you're doing more than an Olympic distance, if you're a triathlete, or more than 2.5 hours of racing.
Right. So in the past couple of years, there has been a new product that's emerged, and basically people said, so maltodextrin, it's essentially, it's glucose molecules strung together, correct?
About maybe 5 to 12 little glucose pearls, little strand connected right. together, exactly.
So it gets cleaved, right, and then separates it into individual glucose molecules, and that glucose is what your muscles use, you know, for energy. It gets stored as glycogen and burned for fuel. So the thought was, well, if we just give you straight glucose, that it saves your body a step, right? So we can maybe possibly absorb glucose through our mouth, through the tongue. We don't even, you know, underneath the tongue, we don't have to swallow it. It doesn't have to go through the small intestines, through the stomach, or anything like that. So what's your thoughts on if you were just to pop straight glucose tabs? I mean, you can go to the drugstore, you know, Walgreens, and get glucose tabs. You can buy glucose powder. You know, so do you think there's benefit to just taking a straight glucose powder for athletes?
Well, I would say for some, and yes, and it's definitely better than just water.
Right.
And so this is a discussion that I often have with endurance athletes. I mean, glucose or dextrose synonymous is very old school. And I ask, and let's take a cyclist or a triathlete, the epitome of innovation seeking. The innovation seeking missile is a typical triathlete. If I can buy a seat or an upright seat post and drop 2 grams, I'm going to spend $150 because that will improve my time. But they're still using Gatorade. I mean, that's a hyperbole, but it's a very common dichotomy where you'll find the athletes focusing on innovation for gear, but not for nutrition. It's really interesting when that happened. Oh, no, I'm good with power bar. Nothing against power, but the bars. I've been using power bars since they were invented in Berkeley. I wrap them still around my tube frame. I'm good. But they have the latest in carbon fiber or tantalum or titanium composites that are out there, platinum, etc. But they're not going to change the nutrition. It continues to boggle my mind why athletes do that. And they're very, very fearful of changing something, let's say 3 months before a race, as if one meal will ruin them and their base, their training base, by changing a supplement one time or a fuel or a drink. It's really, it's superstition personified. So dextrose glucose could work.
Right.
Would it be the best? Perhaps not. You can't take that much. It will cause gut rot or bloating for a lot of people in higher amounts, maybe more than 40, 50 grams at race pace per hour.
So maybe for, I don't really know. I mean, I guess potentially someone that focuses on short course, that does sprint triathlons, Olympic distance, they might be ketogenic during the week and then decide, hey, I'm going to, you know, going to race an Olympic distance. So we've talked about, and if you do that, you're probably not going to have a lot of top end speed. But they could potentially take something like a straight glucose powder, dextrose powder, and be okay for, you know, 2 hours, 2.5 hours, whatever it might be. And then
We do know, Cliff, excuse me for interrupting, but we do know, based on studies going back almost 30 years, that maltodextrin will leave the stomach faster than dextrose. That can translate into less bloating. And if you have less bloating, then people talk about, there's a brand called glucose, G-L-E-U-K-O-S, and they say instantly absorbable. Okay, that's fine. That's correct. But you got to get it through the stomach into the small intestine. And if it doesn't leave there quickly, you are now at a disadvantage. Who cares if it's what you drank or ate? It's what you absorb and then deliver to the brain and to working muscle. If you can't do that quickly, you are going to start underfueling and bonk.
So essentially what you just said is that even though glucose might be absorbed faster, maltodextrin could potentially be more beneficial because it gets out of your gut quicker and into the small intestines. Correct?
Yeah. So you have three or four steps. One is swallowing. And some people have a challenge in swallowing large amounts. So how much can you take in? So you got to get it into your gut. Two, you got to move it through the stomach. And that is like a gatekeeper. If it doesn't leave the stomach, unlike water, which you can absorb from your stomach, you can't absorb carbs from your stomach. You can absorb alcohol. You're not going to be drinking a shot of tequila when you're doing a race in an Ironman in Acapulco. You're not going to be doing that.
Right.
If you're consuming water, you want to deliver fuel, and fuel needs to move the stomach and go to the upper part of the small intestine. And if it's glucose, it's ready to be absorbed, but you still have to deliver it and get out of the gate called the stomach. Maltodextrin will move fast to the stomach. And if it's the right maltodextrin, based upon how long it is, how many little sugar molecules or dextrose molecules, 5, 8, 12, we really don't know that one, which one is best. You will now speed by or pass by dextrose in the stomach. Hey, see you later, dextrose. We're going to the small intestine, but then it has to be digested and absorbed. And with a well-functioning gut, however, not a ketogenic gut, I'll get to that in a second, it may be faster to deliver glucose to blood and therefore to working muscle, to liver, the first target, and the brain, which keeps your brain happy. Now, when you look at a person that's keto-adapted or low-carb-adapted, two things happen. One is that the enzymes that chop up carbohydrates into absorbable fragments, which are made by the pancreas, which also makes insulin, they basically go on vacation. Wow, we're not really seeing many carbs coming down, only 20 grams a day on average. Hey guys, you know, you carbohydrate digesting machinery, the amylase factory, you're going to go on a couple of week vacation. We haven't had any carbs of any amount for a good month. Go on vacation. And then all of a sudden, you start dumping a whole bunch of carbs. Red alert, red alert. We don't have enough carb digesting enzymes. What do? You get bloated. You get constipated. You get diarrhea. You have dumping through your gut. And it takes a couple of days to catch up. That can be a problem. The other carb digesting enzymes are those that actually line the little finger-like projections of your intestine called the villi. That's the things that get chopped up by gluten. People that have celiac disease, they get basically chopped the top off. And these little fingers called villi are where carb digesting enzymes for like two or three sugars hook together. That's where they exist. And they get downregulated. We're going to go on vacation too because we don't have enough out here to keep us busy. And so there's that component that is really not explored well when you're doing low carb, is how the gut can readapt again to an onslaught or a flooding of carbs when it had been receiving a desert little misting rain of carbs once a day. Big unknown topic.
Right. Well, I mean, you just said it's unknown, but I'm going to pose one question and see if you can even take a stab at this. But I'm on a ketogenic diet. I know I've got a race coming up. I'm going to use maltodextrin as my fuel source. If I ingest maltodextrin every day during training, is that enough to keep essentially my enzymes in check and active enough so that on race day, I won't poop my pants?
I like the way you closed that one there.
Thanks.
The key question is how much?
Right.
So if you're trickling in 10 grams, 15 grams, probably not. So It all goes back to dose. Dose defines physiology and the response. So perhaps, but maybe the wise thing to consider would be a couple days, maybe even 3 days. This is all experimentation talk. This is like blue sky applied science talk, because no one's done this work that I've seen in research studies. It's quite invasive too, because we'd have to take a biopsy of the intestines. But
that
for 3 days of being on a relatively higher carb intake diet, with a third day being, or with the fourth day being rice day. So you give your gut a chance to turn the DNA on to make more enzymes again, because, well, we got to, okay, it's coming in. Okay, enzymes, come on back. Time to come back. That may be an interesting approach, because typically the keto-adapted athletes that we've talked to, or that secondhand we've heard of, they're just taking it, carbs in or loading the night before, the day before, and then the morning of, and then consuming carbs during on race day.
Right. All right. So I only said one question, but I do want to talk a little bit about a topic that you brought up on your podcast with Lava Magazine, and that's fecal matter transplants, right? So here's my question. I get some fecal matter from a carb-adapted athlete, and I get a transplant the day before my race, 2 days before my race. Is that going to help my gut flora change in enough time that I can start processing carbohydrate on race day?
Well, it's the important M is not matter, would be microbial, because you don't want to just basically eat crap or take a sample of a stool. It goes through some significant processing.
Right.
But I understand what you're saying. In that context, how it's delivered is one important point. And then two is, would one dose or one day be enough? Probably not. And the most frequent way it's been delivered is through effectively an enema. So they'll put it way up beyond the anal sphincter, sorry to get anatomical there, and put it up in the lower, in the upper large intestine, to actually where you find the bulk of the bugs. The other part it would be interesting to look at would be, and the other way it's been delivered is in a capsule form, where they even put it, the concentrate, into a smoothie, like they did with the kids with autism. I don't think one day would be enough, because it doesn't happen overnight, unlike certain drugs can have an immediate effect.
Right.
Even with living organisms and trillions of them, a couple billion or a couple of 10 billion may not be enough to make a difference in one day. But you can be the guinea pig for that brown bag.
I think I'm good. It's funny. I know Leslie Patterson, I think three-time Xterra world champion. She's had some GI issues in the past. I know she has experimented with fecal matter transplants. So it'd be interesting kind of get her take on that. I mean, and she talks openly about that. I don't know if you know Leslie at all, but she's pretty much very open with everything she does. It'd be interesting to kind of hear her take and how it affected her and helped her out. But I do know, Anthony, that you've worked with a lot of endurance athletes, a lot of ultra athletes. You wrote an ebook, which we'll publish the link to that, that basically gives a probably the best all-around view and look at what we now know about ketogenic diets and performance. So you have athletes that are follow that lifestyle and then use your product Vitargo. Can you tell us a little bit about Vitargo, how it's different, some of the cool things that you guys are doing with that?
The book, Cliff, and thanks for teeing that up, Keto Diets and Performance, Are You the One? The whole premise of the book is to help a reader identify, after reading the research that's been done in athletes on ketogenic diets and confirmed via blood testing, not just by I'm on a low-carb diet, that does not mean you're ketogenic, or I'm taking 25 grams a day of carbs, at least I think I am, that doesn't mean that you're ketogenic, is what happens to performance. And for the athlete that is keto adapted, who on race day choose to get carbs, we have always advocated, Vitargo, and some other people do that. In fact, some would say competitors of ours have advocated Vitargo because of the ease on the gut. And so Vitargo was invented in Sweden in the 90s. The first two studies were done in a lab, a very, very famous scientist lab at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm. And his lab in the 60s proved the concept of carbohydrate loading and endurance or glycogen loading. So very impressive lab. And 20 years later, his lab invented creatine loading for strength, speed, and power. And that's when they got to know him, which led to me co-founding EAS back in late 92. And in 96, he had sent to me, his name was Eric Holtman. He passed away around 6-7 years ago. Super sharp, cool guy, traditional Viking, Swedish. And he had sent me in snail mail a study that they had done with endurance athletes where they had them ride and run to exhaustion, and they gave them either Vitargo in its first generation form or maltodextrin sugar, similar to a gel composition, 300 grams over 2 hours. They did a muscle biopsy right after they exhausted themselves and 2 hours later, and they found, much to his surprise, almost about 1.7 times more glycogen in the quads muscle or quad muscle 2 hours after, even though the amount of carbs was identical. And he had believed going into that study that a carb is a carb. And at that time, there was some evidence indicating a difference, but he didn't think there would be a dramatic difference. So then they did a gastric emptying study, and Vitargo just is one of those unique ingredients that happens to have a ever-growing body of evidence that shows it's different, and that it is very different in its speed and moving through the gut, getting into blood, and getting to muscle. So Vitargo for some people is a go-to product on race day because they just don't get gut rot. And we've had athletes take up to maybe 800 calories an hour. We have one pro triathlete, not top field, or actually elite. He tried to go pro, who at Ironman Kentucky did 1,000 calories an hour for every hour on the bike. No gut rot.
And so if you're listening to this podcast, you can't see what I'm seeing, but as Anthony's telling this 1,000 calories an hour, and he and I have talked about this before, but Lauren, who essentially edits and produces our videos, her face is like, WTF, like, are you kidding me? And I do want to interject real quick. Anthony and I have been friends for a few years, but the day I knew that Anthony wasn't full of bullshit is he was telling me about this, and I said, Anthony, if he's taking 1,000 calories an hour, I was like, and it passes through the gut and it gets in the small intestine and it gets absorbed, what happens to it? And Anthony's response was, Cliff, we simply do not know. And when he said that, I was like, well, he's not trying to BS me, because most people would come up with some excuse. And I mean, I think it's interesting. You're adjusting 1,000 calories an hour. We don't really know what's happening to it. It's going somewhere. I think it's pretty cool. It's kind of like looking into the precipice of what's next.
We can guess.
Yeah.
If it's not coming out the poop chute, if it's not coming up vomiting, and if you're not bloated, there's only one place. You don't sweat it out. It's going into blood and being used by working tissues. And we know from other studies that certain muscle fibers that are not contracting can store glycogen while other muscle fibers are contracting. So there could be an actual glycogen loading coexisting with fuel or glucose utilization from carbs being provided from an outside source. We had work with Slater Fletcher, who in his first Ultraman, which is a 10K swim on day one, he took in 600 calories an hour for every hour of the swim while swimming. And what did your mom tell you when you're going, oh no, make sure you wait an hour after you eat lunch.
Right.
Cramps when you go in the pool or the ocean. He swam competitively. How do you do that? Every 15 minutes, his wife barked out at him, Slater. And he'd come up to the kayak and he'd get a bottle of pre-measured 150 calories of Vitargo and 150 calories. And he would take it in every 15 minutes. Then he went on the bike, did the first thing, 75-mile climbing the hills behind Kona, 800 calories an hour for every hour of the first leg of the bike.
It's nuts, because it goes against everything we've been taught. You know, 60 to 90 grams, depending on size and physiology and heat and exertion and all of these things. And, you know, here you're saying 250 grams per hour. I mean, it's like four times as much as what's been thought that we could we could actively consume. So it's definitely, it's exciting stuff, and it's interesting. And so, I mean, so what do you think is, what's next? I mean, how does it all work together? I mean, is there a benefit to being on a ketogenic diet, you know, 3 weeks out of the month and then loading up on carbohydrate and racing? Or are we better off just consuming a well-balanced diet, making sure that our protein is at the right level, that we're consuming the right amount of carbohydrates during the week? I mean, what's better? What's, you know, advantages of each maybe?
There will always be people that will, I think there will always be people that will respond to a certain diet. Just who are they? And I don't think there are any genetic or any omics or proteomics or any metabolomics tests right now that you can get as a kit or even spend $10,000 on to say definitively you, Clifton, will be a responder to a ketogenic diet for months. And you over there, Lauren, no way. You need to be at least 50% carb diet. We don't know that yet. And part of that unknown factor is the gut microbiome, the bacteria down there. We know from some really interesting work, and I think we mentioned this before, that was done comparing why people are so diverse in their response to the same food and their glycemic index, their blood sugar response. Part of that has to do with their gut flora. And so how can you get 1,000 people given the exact same food and measure their blood sugar response and have a huge difference? Part of that, a significant part, is their unique gut flora. When you change their flora by changing their diet, they become closer to everyone else. They aren't so diverse, and the signal-to-noise ratio becomes improved. So I think for the keto, for the person that believes that they respond better to a keto adaptation lifestyle as an athlete, great. Keep on doing it. Know that it's going to change your gut flora. And as long as you are aware of the, I would say, even on an absolute scale, the need for carbs on race day, and you can find a carb that agrees with your gut, it doesn't, and it works with your fuel belt and your fueling systems, and it's palatable, go for it.
Right. So, Anthony, we know, I mean, we've talked about this, and you've made mention of it a lot of times previously, but 99 times out of 100, you might say 999 times out of 1,000, when studies are done, they're done on men, right? Mm. So have you guys done any studies with Vitargo on women to look at the difference in absorption rates between men versus women?
Well, we've done... A colleague of mine at in Florida did a study with one of his graduate students did it in female soccer players, and they compared it to other carbohydrates. They didn't look at absorption or movement through the gut or gut transit or muscle biopsies, but they just looked at blood sugar responses, which really are very misleading. Just like the scale, using a scale to determine your body composition, using blood sugar to determine how fast something gets in the blood is very misleading. In fact, it can be wrong. It may be high, but it may be slow to get into tissues or get into muscle. It's just not right. It's not correct. We finished up a study at University of North Carolina that we are paying off. Don't have the results of that. That was an endurance trained marathoners, all females. We haven't done head-to-head comparisons, men and women in the same study, but that's the unfortunate thing when you have unfortunately, in most business or industries and in the world of science, the majority of people that are doing the research are not women. And what's probably the most striking example of that are in female breast cancer. Most studies that are being done and published are by men. And that was one of the reasons why we were inspired to create a female brand that was led by had a female management team, not just a science person, but CEOs. Because what better way to communicate the devilish ingredient carbs to women? I mean, if I was to tell a female to take in 100 grams of carbs an hour, I mean, they look at me like I have three heads.
Right.
But if a woman athlete or a woman PhD says that, well, she's in good shape, or she's got a couple gold medals around her neck, maybe I can try it because she understands my body, not that Almada guy over there. What a crack. Crackpot.
So the study coming out of North Carolina is that was all women?
Yes.
So, and when do you guys think that'll come out?
Well, maybe we'll have results by year end, if not earlier.
Okay, awesome. That's very interesting. I mean, obviously, huge difference in the physiology between men and women. I think that any time, and listen, female is one of the fastest growing segments in sport. So I think that, you know, the more that we can do to just understand them and their physiology and how we can help them perform better, then it's better for everyone in the long run. But awesome, Anthony. Thank you so much for this information. It's great. I know I've learned a lot. I hope that our viewers and our listeners have learned a lot as well. Real quick, tell us about where they can find your product if they want to try some Vitargo.
Well, the domain name or the website for our book is thinksportsnutrition.com, as it sounds, THINK, sportsnutrition.com. We'll capture your website, promise not to spam you. You got a free download. We even have it on the iBook store as a free download. So if you are an iBooks reader, or use your iPad or your Mac, you can use it in much more interactive features. We just launched a new website, VitargoUSA.com. We have videos, we have a blog, we have a number of articles, we have stacks of the week from a variety of different athletes. We have some Olympic athletes on there whose names we can mention. And we have our store up, and we'll be adding some things to that. And VitargoUSA.com will continue to be filled out with more and more content. So please visit that. We have a YouTube channel under Vitargo. I think we have now maybe 5 or 6 videos, a couple on some recent studies that we've, David Barr, our senior digital editor of Scientific Affairs, has done quite elegantly. Yeah, keep on visiting.
Awesome. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it. As always, it's been a pleasure to talk to you and, you know, to learn from you. Until next time, I'm Cliff with Breakthrough Nutrition, and that's Anthony with Vitargo Global Sciences. See you next time.
Thanks, everyone.